The following is a presentation of thepublicrecord.ca. This is the second part of a two-part podcast of our discussion on voter turnout in Hamilton that was held on November 19th, 2014. For more information about this podcast and the discussion, visit thepublicrecord.ca.
We're going to do three more questions and bring it to a wrap. Larry's in the audience here, and I assume that tweet was just from you. Do you mind if I make that your question? So one of the goals of these forums, I'm going to try to do them more often, is to start to have audience engagement. This is the first time, so try to keep it simple so that I can fix errors. And there's been a couple with the stream. So Larry's asking, does ranked balloting ask some voters with limited knowledge to do more than they're already willing to do? I'll let Elizabeth, you haven't started us off on one of these questions, so I'll let you start us off.
I don't know what right voting is.
So that's where one, two, so I say this is my first choice, and if he doesn't have 50% of the vote, then the candidate number two is there, and if she doesn't have 50% with everything, then I have a three. So you can
They drop the person giving the lowest ballots and then redistribute their ballots until ultimately someone
okay.
gets the most.
Marvin did a bit, sorry.
How does that relate to what issues you've identified are important to you?
So you can say that candidate X, I really like where they're standing on everything, and I want to vote for them, but I'm afraid that they're going to lose. So instead of, well, I'm going to use the NDP. So instead of voting for the NDP candidate, because the NDP's come in third before, and I don't want to see a conservative candidate, I'm voting liberal. But with ranked balloting, you could vote NDP, and then if the NDP is the last place party and the conservative doesn't have 50%, your vote now can go to the liberal. So you can strategically vote while still voting your heart, for example.
Yes, well, that seems a little more complicated than the average voter would do. I think it's enough to ask people to identify the issues that are significant to them, what change want to see, who they think best represent their concerns, and vote for that person. I'm sure they could rank their second choice, you know, the alternate to their first vote, but I don't see them necessarily ranking all the candidates available for in a particular election.
Yeah, you did a great job of explaining it in sort of a three-party system. Yeah. But even provincially, sometimes you have six, seven candidates. And if you have to rank them from one to six, in this municipal election in Ward 3, I think we had 15 candidates. Ward 13, if I remember correctly, had seven to nine, I think it was. And this then becomes a real issue because even in, and I think I'm a very engaged person, to be candid in Dundas, and that's where I voted, I kind of boiled the race down to three, and then I studied those. I didn't bother with four through nine. I didn't really see anything. Now, if you made me put numbers for those, I would. This is where this rank thing starts to fall apart in my mind when you have a lot of candidates. Think of the Maryland race. We think we had the big three, but I think, again, we had nine people running for mayor. Where do you go after the top two or three?
Well, the thing is, you don't actually have to vote for all the. You don't actually have to rank everybody in a preferential ballot, and so you can rank the people that you believe in most and leave the others off the off your ranking, which gives them a high score, right? Which is also a strategy in that model. I think that when you give people a value proposition, that is that your vote's going to count. You know, you're going to educate yourself a little more on what the candidates are, and you know, media will be more compelled to provide those summaries and whatnot of who stands for what. But you know, right now it seems daunting because that's just not our practice. But I mean, this is something that works really well in many jurisdictions around the world.
Joe, you didn't ask it, but if I turn this slightly differently, I'm not a big believer in incentives for voting. I don't believe we should give you a Tim Hortons coffee when you come out to vote. I don't think we should give you a loonie if you come out to vote, or a tax break. I don't think there should be a lottery. Someone who voted tonight is going to win a new car. I don't think we should do that. This is why I keep going back to this thing with education. It is a duty. I don't know if we use that word enough, of citizenry. You want the benefits of being in a democratic society. There is a duty that you have to pay, and that's this coming out and voting. And so I would rather see something like that than an incentive system either. But if the form of the voting, this is why Alexander's talked about ranking, I talked about the internet, if there are barriers created in the process we have now, so I'll give you another example. There have been some letters to the editor where people complained that the polling station, there were too few in an area, or I had to walk too far, or I couldn't find them. I went to the school. Where the heck was it? It was hidden. I couldn't seem to find it. These are barriers we don't want. So we should be trying to make sure we eliminate as much of those as possible to make it as free. But after that, do I want someone coming out to vote only because they get a lottery ticket? It goes back again to the educated nature. If you're only there to get the lottery ticket, I just don't think I want you voting at all.
So we've got two questions left, and the last one's going to be a short. You're going to make a motion, so start preparing yourselves. This is the question that goes to Alex's expertise. What role can social media and mainstream media, including new media such as myself, play in improving voter turnout?
Well, I mean, most people who use the internet or use social media are listeners. They're not participating. They're not engaging in dialogue. They're just paying attention. So, and if you look at, actually, we just, a study that I just completed with Léger Marketing identifies that 70% of Canadians now are social media users, and of them, over 85% use Facebook. So, I mean, this has become a ubiquitous phenomenon. Everybody's doing it, right? The question is at what level and how? So, I mean, to me, again, social media is a way of spreading a message, telling stories in a multimedia fashion that make those stories come to life. It's a way of having users generate content so that they participate in a conversation. But social media without a real world campaign to match, without a call to action at people's doors or in the world that puts people in contact with other real human beings that aren't just symbols or images on screen won't work, right? I mean, you saw that one of the most active social media campaigns in the last election was Brian McCaddy's. And if you were to judge exclusively by how active he was on social media and how active his supporters were, you'd think that he would have won the election handily, right? But actually came third. And the leader, the winner, Fred, actually didn't have social media as a priority at all, and won because, quite frankly, had a lot of name recognition and was a known quantity and was trusted by a lot of the people who actually were, his team was able to get out to vote, right? So there was the sort of machinery, political machinery there to mobilize people and get them out. Social media, I think, is powerful, but it has to, it's one element of a successful campaign.
Some people who, in spite of the fact that they may be living in poverty, are still quite astutely computer literate, and they do pay attention, and they are knowledgeable, and they do follow the paper. They spend a lot of time at the library accessing the computer there and the newspapers there, and they are knowledgeable. And some of them do vote. And in as much as they know other people in the community, which they could rise up to vote, they could do more if they had encouragement or resources, for example. But I absolutely, positively agree with the public education. It has to take place in schools. It has to be on social media. It has to cover all the bases. But it has to start in the schools, too. In young grades, the importance of civic engagement, the importance of duty to ensuring that your community is as good as it could be because you play an active role in it.
Yeah, Alexandra and I talk about the same social media. I like to say that the World Wide Web is still the wild, wild west, that we're still trying to figure out what all the rules are. You use the example of Brian McCaddy's campaign. Here is a person who definitely tried to engage the grassroots. He specifically went on a listening tour. He posted all the places he went and what he heard at all these places. Marie Robbins, who ran for councillor in Stony Creek, she did the same thing. Every day she posted, when I knocked on doors, here's what I heard today. I could argue and neither of those campaigns were successful, by the way. One that was, of course, Matthew Green, who ran a campaign for councillor that really looked more like a campaign for mayor. Now, in fairness to Matthew, he had a certain amount of support from, I'll call it, an artistic community. So he had some some videos on his Facebook page that were better than any mayor that was running, with wonderful music and cuts and fades and just professionally crafted, but for free from people who were trying to help him. The temptation could be to say it made a difference. I don't know. In a way, I felt Matthew's campaign, he was speaking to the converted. So they like seeing the videos that they produced and reconvinced the people who were already convinced that he was the right guy. I don't know if it made a difference. And while your comment is quite true that there are disadvantaged people who do get computers either through public sources or in other places, it's not clear to me whether that is making a difference to those who've chosen not to participate in the past. That it used to be you'd advertise in something like The Spectator or CHCH and that would get the day. Is social media filling that void? It is for the richer class, I think, the more educated class. I'm not sure that average citizens are tuning in and understanding that. So to Joey's question, all I can say is the rules are still being written. I think if I'm a candidate, so I was going to run, let's say, in 2018, I would need to have a mixed campaign. I'd need to use some traditional media, some social media. I would be trying to measure which had an impact at certain times in the campaign and do more of whatever was working at that time to get my message out. But this is still evolving, and we're still seeing new forms. I even go so far to mention, say, Facebook as a specific example. There was an internet rumor about a month and a half ago that Facebook was going to start charging people, I think it was $5 a month for their account. Now, it's a rumor, and it's not true. But that day in class, I said, show of hands, how many of you have a Facebook account? Every hand went up. How many of you would pay $5 for Facebook? Only about 10% of the students said they would. So here's a ubiquitous tool they all know and love, and they live their lives on it, and yet once you start charging them for it, to me that says something about the value if you wouldn't pay the $5.
Well, and just to add to that, I think to build a successful social media campaign, you have to build a successful following and community around yourself, or if you're an organization, your brand. And, I mean, you know, while Brian, for example, had, you know, a lot of engagement during the campaign, I mean, he sort of went 0 to 60 on social media and really didn't have much of a presence beforehand. And so I think it's next to impossible to start, especially when you don't have a party machinery behind you that's you know, that you inherit, you know, a Liberal brand or a Tory brand, mm-hmm. or an NDP brand. If you're in municipal politics, if you're on your own and you're trying to start build a social media community in 1 year around yourself, once you've named yourself, once you've come out as a candidate, very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it just didn't work for him. Yeah.
So, the last question. You're in the role of a city councilor, and you're going to move a motion to do one thing to try to address the problem of voter turnout. What would you move to do? Start with Alex.
Good. Start with Alex.
Put Alex on the spot. What would I move to do? I would move to change the voting system if possible. Some form of preferential ballot.
I would. I think an issue a lot of people could get behind would be to change the delivery model of social assistance.
Yeah, I'm stuck. I got to do a two-part motion on you, Joey. I'm sorry. On one hand, as city councilor,
you are a real city councilor.
As a city councilor, I think what we could do as city council would be internet voting. But at the same time, I would pass a motion requesting that the Board of Education, in the year leading up to the election, do more in civic engagement there and trying to teach our younger generation, and then hoping that they'll then go back and engage their parents.
So I want to thank everybody for watching online, being here in person. This was the first time that we've done this, and it was sort of a test pilot beta of doing a live discussion in a pub, so keep an eye on thepublicrecord.ca. We're going to make this a regular part of our coverage and our engagement, because one of the things that I want to address is voter engagement and discussions and get it into the community. So I also want to thank the George Hamilton Pub, who provided the venue today for this event. So they're at Bay and King, right close to City Hall. I sneak over over here quite a lot for their lasagna. I want to especially thank the panelists who came out today. I want to thank Dr. Disc, who provided some extra audio equipment today. So they're good guys. And I want to thank Mark behind the camera, Laura behind the soundboard for volunteering their time as well. And I want to thank everyone who supports my journalism, because, you know, it's all crowdfunded and it's all voluntary contribution. So I want to thank everyone for coming out, and have a great night.
This has been a presentation of the Public Record. Thank you for listening.